Yes! Yes! You're the man now, dog!
Welcome back to another episode of Quarantine Reviews. My name is Jamie, and on the other line is Aiden. What's up, man?
How's it going? Coming to you from La Conner, Washington. It was a blistering 38 today, degrees.
Pretty fucking good. God, cold. Did you go in the water?
No. I wanted to, but I was actually skating. Got back too late, but man, maybe tomorrow. Maybe tomorrow when I have the sunset, I'll do it. But I mean, I did it like 3 days ago and it was also like 40 degrees, so it can't be that much different.
Yeah, maybe I could try and take a dip in the LA equivalent, which, you know, it's a chilly 62 down here. And yeah, the ocean. I just was a little traumatized from the last time I went swimming out in the Pacific because a couple waves thrashed me pretty hard. I don't know if you've seen the film The Impossible with what's her name?
Sorry, I'm burping.
I can't remember her name. Anyway, The Impossible on the 2004 tsunami. It was basically the best reenactment you can do of like a 26-year-old male alone.
You're not
on
the most
beach.
Aquatic man, though.
I'm
grew up by the water, but we, you know, the water seems to take a toll on you.
Yeah, that's the problem with me is I've never lived more than like 5-ish miles away from a large body of water, and I'm probably the worst swimmer on the planet.
Yeah, you would not do well in a flood.
So, yeah, waves, tsunamis. Today we have our own tsunami, and that's the post-election special. We just had election results.
Sleepy Joe, baby.
Sleepy Joe. Depending on which side you're on, the election may not be completely over in your mind, but to the general populace of forward-thinking humans, Joe Biden is our president. So we figured we'll give you a little election special and do a politics movie. And so we've chosen All the President's Men from 1976, and then a look ahead to our second movie. We'll just be covering two this episode. Second movie is going to be Finding Forrester, and that's going to be our rest in peace Sean Connery movie this episode. But yeah, so All the President's Men, Aiden, we chose this, I mean, for a lot of reasons. I think we had just covered Vice, and we were thinking about other politics movies. And this one just came to mind, pretty much.
Yeah, it's a, you know, I feel like we haven't done many old movies, and this is definitely an older one, but also one that is, you know, kind of a classic as American cinema goes. Has two huge, big name actors in Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. So
yeah, exactly. And this has just a wealth of American political pop culture information to it, and like you said, it's a classic. It's a household name as far as like American cinema goes, and I think a big reason why is the story is so big and dead on as far as like the facts go. And yeah, so this story, if for those who don't know, All the President's Men is about the Washington Post reporters Bob Woodard and Carl Bernstein, who uncover the Watergate scandal that eventually led to Nixon's resignation. So this one, and then probably the other big Nixon movie is Nixon. Did you ever see that one, Aiden?
No.
Yeah, Nixon, but, I've heard is phenomenal as well. But this is, that's the Oliver Stone one. But this is more of the journalism aspect.
Because we're journalism movie.
Yeah, because these two characters, these are real people. These are the two main characters are the two journalists, reporters who wrote the book after uncovering all this. So it's all pretty tight as far as the true story goes. And in classic American fashion, they made it pretty quickly after all this went down.
Yeah.
But some of the basics of waste no time. I saw
it was like Apocalypse Now. They filmed while Saigon was falling.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, no, get those Vietnamese jumping towards the helicopter there. That's perfect.
Right. Yeah, not staged at all. And, you know, I saw somebody talking about that, how they're like, hey, let's go start a war over there. And then, 2 years later, we'll go back and make a movie about how our vets are severely damaged from it.
Yeah, well, celebrate us in their country.
Yeah, right. It's like it's this weird, like, internal system of revenue. Kind of creepy if you think about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers.
Right. Another topic for another time. All the President's Men won Best Adapted Screenplay, which was a given. I mean, you have a book right in front of you. Yeah.
A book written by journalists, professional writers.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's just like a given pretty much. It also won Best Supporting Actor, Jason Robards, who played Ben Bradley.
CEO or whatever that was. Mm-hmm. head editor.
Yeah. One art direction, and then it also won Best Sound. And this is the main, aside from screenplay, this is the main award that I really think stuck out to this movie. The details in the sound in this movie are huge. The typing, the file, like, mm-hmm. the whole feel of being at the Washington Post. I don't know about you, Aiden, but this really, really stuck out to me. You know, 40 years later, I feel like this is still an accomplishment from this film.
Definitely puts you... And it makes you very excited about journalism. I found during it, I was like, man, what an awesome job. It seemed like a shitty job, but an awesome job at the same time. But yeah, you're just stuck in the writing room and you felt like you were kind of just like a random employee in the corner watching the whole movie.
Exactly. Yeah. The pros and cons of such a hustle of a career. Mm-hmm. And then it was nominated for Best Picture, Director, Editing, Supporting Actress for Jane Alexander, but zero for Redford or Hoffman. What do you think that's about? Aside from it being a competitive year, you think this was just, they both like kind of comboed so well that it...
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't any range shown. They didn't show any other emotion besides like hustling.
Yeah.
Insanely happy moments. There was no sad moments. There was just like frustration and hustling. Oh, we got to get the story. And that's about it, really. Yeah, and they did a great job at it, but it was just like, I think, you know, to win an Oscar, you need an intense topic where you get to show like your range as an actor.
That's true. They're really just on the chase and the trail of the story most of the time.
Yeah, huh? and they did a great job for that purpose, but it's just not a movie that sets you up for that.
Yeah, good point. Well said. And so just some context too. Same year as Logan's Run, Carrie, Rocky, Taxi Driver,
Good Luck,
Network. So yeah, Good Luck, exactly. They were just like masterclass performances all around. I don't know if this was just back in the day or this happened to be a good year for movies, but fuck, there were some...
Yeah, wait, did De Niro win it or what?
No, he didn't.
Wow.
He didn't. I can't remember the guy's name from Network. I don't know if you've seen that. That's mm-mm, a fucking classic. There's some scenes I guarantee you've seen, but we should definitely cover that. Network is phenomenal, and I'm pretty sure he won it. That actor won it posthumously. And another, you know, as I'm going down the basics for All the President's Men, first time that follow the money catchphrase originated from.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah. And it wasn't even in the book. That was an addition to the screenplay.
Nah, that was just fucking Robert Redford being an adaptive actor.
Yeah.
He said it and then he looked at the camera and the director just fucking came in his pants. Yeah, maybe we could follow the money. Oh my god!
He flared his nostrils a couple of times. Like, wait, are you smelling it?
Leave that in. Hey, no, don't stop the scene. You keep going.
The funny thing about that is your Redford impression is very close to the truth. Everything I was reading about this, like Redford was calling shots left and right.
He just looks like he is.
Yeah, and the studio only agreed to finance this movie in full if Redford was the lead, and then after that he was like everything I was reading about this was Redford chose this. Dustin was his second option. His first was Al Pacino.
Oh Jesus. I mean,
yeah, that would have been, though, doesn't it?
It fits, but it would have been quite the different role. It would have been like, we gotta find this story, you know, he would have done something over the top. You're like, all right, man. I feel like Dustin Hoffman did a good job playing like kind of a kind of an annoying weasel almost.
No, I totally agree. I feel like Pacino, he would have had to say something like, hey man, that guy was never packing. He's like, no, it's just a Glock, you know, he probably had one on him. Yeah. No, there were no no weapons.
Al, quit bringing weapons to the movie. Hey, now exactly. Let me tell you something.
Anyway, so this is such a familiar movie. I'll just share a couple thoughts on my perspective, and then I'll hand it over to you, Aiden.
Uh-huh.
I feel like this movie is a really good reminder, watching it here in 2020, that people have been wilding out for politics, American mm-hmm. political parties, like throughout history. Yeah. And I kind of say this in attack of the people who like to say, there's never been a time like this. There's never been a time where people were going crazy for so-and-so. There's a lot of original television segments that are played in mm-hmm. this movie.
Yeah.
And people are going buck fucking wild, like crazier yeah. than some Trump rallies. So I thought that alone is a good reminder, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, well, also, like, the world, or at least the voting world, was so heavily Republican in this time that, like, a constant theme throughout the whole thing is, like, you know, this is the president of the United States. We don't want to deface him. Like, I'm a Republican. I love my country. Like, that was a reoccurring theme. They're like, how can we present this story accurately without shitting on this dude unnecessarily? Like, they were trying to almost protect democracy and the government, mm-hmm. whereas, like, now, like, that narrative is so far gone.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's definitely fanatics at all times, but I don't know. It's tough to tell. At the same time, Nixon was, like, super hush-hush about this. He was a very, like, you know, he was a politician, so he, like, spoke, like, very vaguely and was, like, we're trying our best to do this investigation and shit like that. Whereas Trump would be like, yeah, I'm innocent. I'm innocent. Fuck them or whatever, you know?
Right. But similarly contentious.
Yeah.
These two periods of time. And
no, it was a very appropriate movie for sure.
Mm-hmm. And I really liked into the movie. There's a scene where they're trying to get some information from a guy at another office, and Redford says, or well, the guy they're interviewing says, I'm a Republican. And then Redford immediately says, well, I am too. And then Hoffman gives a sharp and stern look to Redford.
Definitely not Republican.
And he holds it for a second, like a really meaningful, like, if this is true, we have, like, separate personal beef. But they left it at that, and I kind of liked it. It was a nice little
if you had to pick who was the Democrat and the Republican, it was definitely Democrat was Hoffman and Redford was Republican. But at the same time, he was like, oh, this story is the most important thing.
Uh-huh. And I thought this movie, so it is a journalism movie, so we got a lot of, like, office work. But with that said, I thought it kept a really steady pace. It didn't let up. It kind of showed us where we were going from the beginning and took us all the way into the end. And it never felt, like, forced. It was a little slow here and there, but nothing, you know, grinding to a halt.
No. What did you think? What I noticed in especially 70s movies and older movies, they'll have, like, really long, drawn-out shots, mm-hmm. and there wasn't that many in this, just because it was such a fast-paced movie. They're trying to develop the story. There was, like, the one where Redford was, like, running after his meeting with fucking Deep Throat or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they chose that. I guess that must have been his real name.
No, that's his real alias.
Really?
Not his real name, but that's the FBI agent, mm-hmm. and his alias, because, you know, the guy in the... He would show up in a parking garage, super dark, and feed them information.
Oh, so did he really not get a look at his face? Was that, like, a whole thing? The whole time I was like, Jesus,
the secrecy.
Man,
the secrecy was real. Face. That reporter knew who he was, and
but didn't release it to anyone, like a good old American.
Ever, ever, ever. And then on that dude's deathbed in 2003, he spilled it all. He was like, "Yep, that was me. I was the informant. All this stuff." So,
yeah, that fucking wild. That the whole thing was kind of crazy. But I thought the movie was fast paced and it kept you engaged through the whole thing. And if you think about it, there was so much screen time for fucking Hoffman and Redford. Like, the whole movie was they were in all the shots almost.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of crazy. And it just was like, if you break down the movie, it's just them interviewing more and more people, digging. That's the whole movie. And like, there's a lot of ways that can be done poorly. Like if you have the same kind of scenes set up every time, like you're investigating this person and that person and this person interviewing, like it's an easy way for you to be like, oh, this movie fucking sucks, but they did a great job.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in each interview was different.
Mm-hmm.
And like the fact that he went back to that woman who they talked to the first time,
mm-hmm.
and then went back again, like it showed that, like, I don't know, a lot of times when you get what you need from something, you're just like, all right, we're done. And then I thought they were going to come up with another way to get the rest of the information. He's like, well, we need to go back to her, like she has more. And then so I thought that was pretty cool and like pretty original for like a 70s movie, because I feel like they stuck to quite the routine.
Yeah, they did. And they didn't try to force any of the boring parts and make them seem interesting, which was one of my problems with Spotlight, which, you know, I'm going to make multiple parallels to that because they're very similar. Where in Spotlight, like they would have Mark Ruffalo rush with some papers, sprint to another office and try to make that seem like, oh no, the deadline. He gets there like, sorry, sir, we open at 9. Oh, damn it, I'll have to wait for 20 minutes. Like, that's not interesting. Stop trying to make that seem like all of a sudden, we have like
20 minutes.
A thriller because this guy didn't make it to the office.
Dude, also in Spotlight, shout out to the one priest who was like, oh no, I touched them, but I wasn't punishing them. They enjoyed it. And the girl's like, what the fuck are you?
And then his caretaker overhears and has like hushes him back. Oh no, come back inside.
No. You never did that. No. They all asked, I think.
Yeah. And what I did wasn't shit. I mean, I never, you know, I never give them one in the rear.
Yeah, no, I just hand stuff.
You know? Nothing major.
But yeah, no, this movie I thought did a great job keeping it moving. I enjoyed all of it, and for a movie that came out in the 70s, I thought really held up.
Oh, easily. Yeah, and holds up well, man.
Had no problems. I loved the ending where they use the typewriter to because you know how movies will have end credits and be like, he disappeared to Vietnam and was never seen again or whatever. They follow whatever character. Instead, they just had it all through the typewriter, which I thought was super cool. I got a lot of fucking season five, The Wire vibes, where they spend a ton of time in the newsroom as well, like typing out for the like serial killer that's not really a serial killer because McNulty's just fucking with him. It's good stuff.
That take, you took the words out of my mouth. The ending I thought was so good. It was simple and it was so creative, and it played, like you said, on the idea that words are weapons. So you're punching the typewriter while guns and cannons are going off. And I just, like what you said, I'm so, like, why haven't other true story movies built on this? It's such a subtle yet significant part of true stories that everybody remembers, you know, the ending scenes where they start to explain about, oh, this person went on to do this and that. This person was in jail for the next 20 years. And it's always some really boring, like, fade away font. Yeah.
White letters over black screen.
Yeah, and maybe with some music in the background. There are so many different ways to execute the ending.
Think about fucking Napoleon Dynamite's intro scene where it was like everything was on sandwiches and food and shit.
Yeah, exactly.
You could do it anyway.
Yeah, and I feel like the creativity like is rarely applied to it. So yeah, I'm right there with you. That was a standout finish for me.
Yeah, I another big thing for me was that, you know, there was no real like fluff to this. You could have taken this story so many different, like you could have added a love interest with one of the interviews. You could have, you know, I don't know. There was like different, you know, movie expectations that you could put on it. Like there could be a huge twist, but there really wasn't a huge twist, or there could be, and they just stuck to like the brass tacks and stuck to the story, and the story is what drove the whole movie forward. And I thought that was pretty awesome.
Oh yeah.
You could cheap out and add something that's not relevant and not truthful, and they just didn't, and they still made a really engaging story.
Oh yeah, I'm with you 100%. But that's a good segue into like my main con or like big question that sticks out to me. Is this boring to non-American viewers slash people who are uninterested in global affairs? Because the bulk of this movie is phone calls, note-taking, inquisitive conversations, trying to pull out, you know, different pieces of the story, small or big. There's not a lot of like truly satisfying scenes or like heated relationships, like you were saying. No. So not it made me they curious.
Like their biggest conflict is when he's like, "You rewrote my thing," and he's like, "Yeah, I just thought it was a little inaccurate." You should, and then he's like, "Yours is better." And then that's the end of their conflicts.
Yeah, and it set the stage for their
like partnership.
Know, yeah, which worked really well because they were able to uncover probably the biggest political scandal in the last 100 years of the U.S. I would say.
For sure. Right? I just like this is like such a not has nothing to do with anything, but. Man, how much coffee did they drink at night in this movie?
Oh, like
how crazy is it?
That's the
journalist. Can I get you some coffee? Right, and you're like, oh yeah, sure. It's 9 p.m.
Yeah.
The fuck are you doing? I'm going to sleep in a few hours. Why would I drink coffee?
These guys don't sleep, man.
Yeah, that was another part was they just were up all the time.
Have you been to DC?
No. When I was like 6 or something. Yeah.
Okay, I went recently. That place is booming. Even during quarantine, people were up. And like getting things done early morning, late night, like they drink a lot there and they clearly like their coffee as well. So I kind of liked just that general vibe that goes on there, man.
It's got to be like kind of an old, I don't know. It's kind of like the engine of the U.S., that city. So like they're just, you know, sleep is not as important. You know, they're just like, I got to maximize, you know, this is for the greater good.
Yeah.
So they're like, I'm going to bed at 2, waking up at 6, and I'm going for a run, and I'm staying productive. So I get it. Yeah, like, going for it's a run, just not, yeah. not for me. So
yeah. Well, I mean, the political aspect of it is not for me. The burnout is not for me. But while I was there, I was like, I would love to live here just to be surrounded by productivity.
Yeah.
You know, and then let that influence myself, because it's like, yeah, if you go out to hang out with people, they're also going to be like working on shit. And it's like, I would love to be a part of that, because my lazy ass in the Northwest, as you know, you surround yourself by the wrong people up there.
Oh, you get nothing stuck. Done.
Yeah.
You get nothing done at all.
Anyway, so yeah, non-American, my point about like non-Americans and stuff. So I looked up, thankfully there's some data on IMDb of like non-American reviews, and they were lower. For this movie, which I think is fair. Like, if
I mean, what do they care, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like they said, the tagline of this movie, the most devastating detective story of this century.
Nah.
It's definitely the most of in the U.S., but of this Not century. Even,
there's like fucking pedophile murder rings that are more True. Important than this. But like, it was just everyone knows about it.
Yeah. And it was like, if they got away with it, then they would have, you know, conned their way into a pretty high position. So it depends on where you look at the magnitude, because like immediate impact with like what you said, you know, pedophilia, so whatever.
I have a little fun fact on this. My mom was a kid, I think, when Nixon had, because this was his second 4 years or first. I don't really remember, to be honest. But when Nixon was... Yeah. So he had a first 4 years from 69 to 74. And then and 74 he
was
going,
this was his incumbent reelection that he.
Yeah. So he won and then ended up getting impeached because of everything. Mm-hmm. But my mom would gotten. So I guess a big thing was like, I don't know. They just talked differently in the 70s. But my mom would argue with her parents, like, I want to go do this, or like, I want to eat this candy, or whatever the fuck the situation was. And my grandparents would be like, why don't you write a letter to the president? My mom, being my mom, did it at like age 12. Wrote a letter to Richard Nixon. And was like, Mr. President, my parents won't let me, you know, spend the night at my friend, or whatever it was. And someone wrote a letter back. It wasn't Nixon, but it was like some, like, you know, manager. And was like, well, little Miss Huggins, I think that you need to respect your parents, and they are the wealth of knowledge, and they'll lead you to the future or whatever, some shit. And she was just like, so I was a big Nixon supporter. I mean, he talked to me. I knew him personally. I was like, this is the weirdest shit I've ever heard.
That's hilarious, man. Imagine also, yeah, that sounds like 70s as fuck. Imagine if like all the people on Instagram that are like, write a letter to your congressman, write a letter to so-and-so. If they all got one back from like some intern who was like, hey, you know, maybe get in touch with your parents, or hey, you know, maybe work on your own life.
It's good for you.
Work on your career a little bit. I've got your unemployment record right in front of me.
Yeah, you seem angry about a lot of things. You don't have a job. And you've met my mom's dad, and I just imagine him like her reading the note and be like, "Look, Nixon wrote back," and he'd be like, "Good man," or something like that. Like, of course you'd write back. That's our president.
Yeah, you better listen to him.
Yeah, what do you say, your parents? Yeah, he knows what he's talking about.
All right, we're 25 minutes in. I'll give my overall. I mean, if you're not buying into the significance of this story, like I said, the experience is just not going to be as good, because if you don't carry the magnitude of what happened, it's really hard to enjoy the subtleties of it. But with that said, this is a classic. True story, American free speech journalism film. And it provides a timeless reminder that Americans have the capability of discovering truth, no matter the scale, pretty much. I know there seems to be some like pessimism as far as like what the man controls and doesn't control. But I think this is such a healthy reminder that the U.S. is unique because of that free speech aspect.
Yeah, the freedom of speech is very important to our nation, for sure. And this movie shows that.
So this lands at a late 7 for me that I'm going to round up to a flat 8. So this is going to be a great fucking movie, because true stories fuck it up all the time, man. Like, this is the classic example of they had one job and they fucking nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
Point blank.
Yeah, no, before you'd even said yours, I'd already decided on a flat 8 as well. It's just a good fucking movie, and it just knows its job and just sticks to it and does it, and that's like pretty much it. And it delivers. It's got two big actors. The script's awesome. I honestly didn't find many flaws in it. Some of the bigger ones would just be like, it's outdated, and like I've seen other things happen, but like even the fact that it's from 76 or something, it still holds up and it's still a great movie, and that doesn't happen that often. And
I liked it. Which one did you like more, this or Spotlight?
This one. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I like Spotlight because
just won Best Picture, so I mean, this definitely holds up.
Yeah, Spotlight. I mean, because it was just like a more personal touch. I liked it just because I grew up Catholic and like knew about this shit, but as far as like objectively what's a better movie, it's definitely this one. And I mean, I could see why people from other countries don't like it, but if you're also just like a movie fan and you like good movies, I could also see you liking it a lot, being like, oh, this is like a solid movie. But if you're like an average movie fan and you know, don't really care about the U.S. and I could see you just being like, why is this story so important, like why do I care? So
Yeah,
and I give it a flat 8.
The ratings weren't significantly lower.
It's still a good movie. It's just
I think it was like
I could see myself being like, this seems important to them, but like not really being able to attach myself to it.
Right. Yeah, and yeah, so flat 8 from both of us. Of course, like we always say, you know, two movies are never rated on the same spectrum necessarily. Like, you know, this lands around like a 7.8 ish for me.
It's just flat 8.
Flat 8. Okay, so yeah, like, you know, Parasite I had like a low 8, or like a 8.82 or something that would fall back to 8, so obviously not in the same realm as far as that goes. But
no,
regardless, a great fucking movie. Good that, watch
that Robert Redford, man. What a fucking good looking man his whole life he's been. Also just a good old Republican boy. I feel like there's no way he's a liberal just by the way he looks.
I was thinking the same thing. I was like, you know, there were people look back to the 70s like, oh my god, that hair. And if you look at Redford, it's like, oh my god, that hair, he fucking rocked it.
He still has it too.
Yeah.
He's just he's the man. I don't know. He just plays that like he could have played James Bond if he wanted to, because he was just this class act and like good looking.
Agreed. But,
also been around for so long.
So long. The death of Paul Newman, I feel like, just helped. He just took what Newman did and was like, "Yep, I'm gonna take that and run."
I'm just gonna be this classy guy who like doesn't show a lot of emotion ever, but is like, you can rely on him for being solid and never wavering.
Mm-hmm.
Just some good old American stuff. But yeah, no, he has to be like a pretty hardcore Republican just based on his jawline, you know?
Yeah, you never know. Hollywood.
You can just tell. But no, he's still acting, I think. Like, I don't think he acts as much, obviously, but yeah, he's producing more now than acting, and he's directing. But yeah, no, he's doing light acting, but he's like getting into everything. I'm sure he's fucking just loaded. He's been in the business for so long.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, he's an established guy. Okay, now for our second half of this segment, Aiden, rest in peace, Sean Connery.
Yeah, RIP, man.
Share some thoughts on Sean Connery and take us into Finding Forrester.
I mean, Sean Connery is a Scottish man who in the 50s broke into the American roles and like started having mainstream roles, and by the 60s and 70s was a household name in the US, which like, I mean, now is more normal, but I don't think we let any other foreigner just hang around way back then, you know what I mean? And so I think he might have been one of the first ones to do it, where you're like, oh, love Sean Connery. Oh, James Bond? Yeah, love him. Like, all throughout the U.S. And I feel like to do that at the time that he did that was pretty groundbreaking, and you had to really stand out.
You had to be one of a kind, exactly, which he clearly was.
Yeah, he definitely is. And so for me, I knew him as James Bond, but when I grew up, it was Finding Forrester was his big one that I'd watch. And so we decided on Finding Forrester to commemorate him. And it's a 2000, I guess, like drama film ish. It's not like super dramatic, but and it was directed by Gus Van Sant, who's done Good Will Hunting and Elephant and a few others that I'm not naming that are really big. But and it follows a teenager named Jamal Wallace in the Bronx, who is just like a very intelligent, has a really high IQ, and also kind of like lives in the projects and likes to play basketball. And it kind of follows his relationship with Sean Connery's character, who goes by the name of fucking, what's his name? William Forrester. And he's a like famous writer. He's fictional, but he's a famous writer that also lives in the Bronx and is like is up in this window, like spying on people because he's agoraphobic and kind of an alcoholic. And so there's just a bunch of legends about him. And the way Jamal interacts with him is by his friends dare him to break into his house and steal something because they like think it's haunted and you won't come out alive. And that's how he first develops a relationship with him. And the movie's got Busta Rhymes in it, which you love to see. Anna Paquin.
I loved it.
Anna Paquin
also loved it.
So Jamal's story is basically develops his friendship with Finding Forrester, or with William Forrester, who helps Jamal develop his writing because William Forrester is a very famous writer. And they kind of, it's that like story where he's like, later Sean Connery had been like, well, I thought I was going to teach him something, but in turn he taught me, or whatever, you know, like it's that, like, you know, two people who are not supposed to get together and they like build each other up and want the best for each other. And they have a genuine like friendship, even though one of them's like fucking 70 and the other one's 16. So Jamal gets invited to go to a really prestigious school in New York because of his test scores. And he takes, in particular, his English and his writing skills are very like well ahead of his age. And that's how him and William Forrester, Sean Connery, develop and interact. And yeah, it's a great movie. I've enjoyed it a lot. Jamie, you got things to say about it?
Yeah, really quick. So thematically, this movie is a writing movie, and it's set in New York City in the Bronx. So that's mostly what you're getting here, is a lot of English literature references and whatnot. This yeah. movie is not two things. It is not a white savior movie. I think that for those who are listening to this podcast, and if you like go look up a trailer or something like that, you might be worried. You see this inner city black kid with this older white male. And the reason why I say for certain it's not, because Jamal's ability was his ability as a writer, it persisted with or without Forrester.
Yeah.
Forrester helped him develop, obviously.
He did get into the school without him too.
Yes, he did. He was, and Forrester already knew this. Jamal was on a path already to do great things.
Mm-hmm.
Forrester acted there as a person, like a catalyst, helped him develop more than he would without him, obviously. But the true like skill in nature wasn't like given to him by Forrester by any means.
Yeah,
so
it wasn't,
I think,
like direct instruction. It was just like, we just write.
Yeah, it was on
writing, do the talking.
This movie was so powerful because the characters were so well shaped, and
they're,
I
also
think it's
both super intelligent. Like Jamal started out very smart.
Exactly. Jamal's apprehension was already it was already there. And the second thing this movie is not, it's not Freedom Riders. It's not get me out of the hood mentality at all. Like
there's no like talk of that at all.
No, there's not. And there's no cheap like scenes as far as like nobody like gets like robbed or killed abruptly. And
there's no crime in the movie whatsoever.
Right. And not to say that like, you know, avoiding that is what made it good, but I really liked how Gus Van Sant put the weight of the story on the characters and not up to some sort
on
of
their
like,
relationship specifically.
Yeah, exactly. And it had nothing to do with random circumstance. And I think that is something that is rare today in modern cinema.
And you couldn't even say it, like there's a few basketball scenes in it and like he has the basketball like throughout the movie, but I wouldn't I could not categorize this as a basketball movie. Like,
no, definitely
that was
not
so far in the background.
But you know what's exceptional about that aspect? The basketball scenes were done so well. Everybody involved in the pickup games or in the varsity basketball games actually played. Like Jamal had a real release. He was doing like up and unders and shit that like you have to have played for like at least 5 years.
They filmed a scene in Madison Square Garden too, like where the finals were, I guess, or whatever.
You're right. Yeah, this movie, man, was so good because they really gave the attention to detail, and they started and ended with that relationship, like you were saying. Sometimes, and this was the character Jamal, the actor that played him, Rob Brown, this was his first role, and I mean, Jesus Christ, what a role.
Yeah.
You know, playing the, like, second half to Sean Connery. Pretty intense, and I think he did a superb job. Sometimes he delivered lines like a robot, like the whole BMW rant.
I was like, we got to talk about that.
Then there's the conjunction rant where they're in the apartment arguing over like what a conjunction means, and Jamal like rants this like really robotic thing. Like it felt like he had to like reread the script 50 times to get it, and I don't blame that on that actor. He shouldn't have been tasked with that because
deliver that line.
Yeah, because he's not like fact-based autistic smart. He's naturally I'm digging myself a shitty hole here.
No.
You know what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, he's not like unemotional and unopinionated. He's emotional and opinionated, whereas like if you're on the spectrum heavily, you just like are straight facts and you're like 14, 62, 57.
Right, exactly. And when he was spewing out the BMW stuff, that's when I was like, okay,
I hated that part.
Right. And I don't know, man, that might be a little 90s flair, which there are definitely some 90s.
I think it was because it's just like, so basically what we're talking about, there's a scene. So where Sean Connery lives is also in the Bronx. And so, but he's like this legendary writer. And He has an assistant because he's an agoraphobe and but rich and successful. So he has an assistant come and bring him food and like alcohol and stuff to stock him up so he doesn't have to leave his house. His assistant always locks his car and it's like this BMW and he like locks it a bunch of times on purpose because he doesn't want anyone to steal from it because it's like the Bronx is a high crime area. Anyway.
And you can tell he thinks he's hot shit. So Jamal wants to say something about that.
So Jamal goes over to him because he wants to talk to him about his backpack that's in there and so when he went to break in, he left his backpack because he was scared because he thought no one was there or he was asleep. But really, like, Sean Connery's character is just an agoraphobe that doesn't leave his house. So, like, he's always there. Anyway, so I think he went to go talk about getting his backpack back. And he's just like, hey, man. He's like, it's just a car, you know. You don't have to lock it a bunch of times. He's like, just a car? This is a BMW. This is my Nazi sleigh. He says something like of that, you know, nature. And Jamal is like, he's like, you wouldn't know a thing about the history of BMW. And then Jamal is just like, BMW started in 1934, was a great company, started by Nazis. And he just recites this whole thing. He's like, except for he does it. And he's like, and that's why that like propeller's there or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, that's a right. plane propeller. And the guy's like,
yeah.
Oh, I've been one-upped. I've been shit on.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene I thought was very corny. But I mean, it was also literally the year 2000. So it's probably filmed in 99. So like it hadn't been overdone so many times. So to them, they're like, oh, this makes, we have to just, you know, display how smart he is.
And
but he seemed more of like a good writer and like a deep thinker, less of like a fact person, but
exactly. Yeah. But luckily these scenes are few and far between.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and that's anytime you're looking at a movie, there's going to be some sort of thematic elements that are going to be a product of that era. And that's what I chalk that up to. So I don't.
Yeah, for sure.
I noticed that it stuck out, but it didn't hurt because it wasn't very often, like I was saying. And I think this is a reason why you, Thelonious, and a lot of people hated Green Book was because they had those types of corny elements, 90s elements,
and
but it was made
2020.
Yeah, exactly.
What do we do with the chicken bones?
I was throwing them, of course. You know, I tried to change back to Finding Forrester, but I wasn't quick enough.
I
knew that was coming.
Fucking Mahershala is like, you just throw them out the window, and Viggo Mortensen is like, yeah, why the fuck not? And then, God, I fucking hate that part.
So Rob Brown that played Jamal first time actor, and he did a superb job aside from the couple 90s moments. This movie is filled with subtleties that have such a nice touch, like the books, whenever Jamal accidentally leaves like a book in Sean Connery's shelf out of place. Mm-hmm. He's like, he needs to put it back in, and he slowly learns that. And like, there'll be mid conversation later on in the movie, and Jamal was reading a book, puts it back, but doesn't push it all the way in, and the conversation just stops. They look at each other. Jamal like just looks back at the book, pushes it in, and Forrester, without like batting an eye, continues. And I was like, okay, that's fucking
as we
good.
Were saying, Jamal. Maybe
that's
you get
Gus
on those
Van
knees
Zant,
and
baby.
Shuck this dick.
That's Gus Van Sant, man, and that's good acting.
There's a lot of detailed things. I also, not to interrupt, but I loved that the Anna Paquin and him didn't become a relationship. Once again, here's another angle for this to be, the main character has a relationship with someone, and they didn't delve into it, and I really liked that. They left it like friendly, and she was just like a nice person that was showing around the school, and they were friends. And
I'm with you 100%, man. And I feel like some people are going to be like, well, what happened with his high school fling? And it's like, who gives a fuck? That's not
the point of the story.
It was so many, you know, stories down from where everything was jumping off. Like it was a really, really nice touch, and it felt authentic, and they left it at that. And fuck, man, that I really appreciated
that.
Because they could have easily gone into,
it could have been that, and then like they had that scene where the dad was like staring at him when they were on her roof or whatever, but then they didn't delve into that either. He was just like, honey, we have to go say bye to the guests, and he like gave him a little look like, that's my daughter, but then that was it for the rest of the movie. And then he interacts mm-hmm. with her dad again on the school board. And he doesn't mention anything about it. And he's not even worried about that part. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that was really cool and really forward thinking of them, to be honest, because it'd be so easy to just start to delve in that direction. But yeah, man, I thought it was pretty good. Loved Busta Rhymes in it. He was pretty like I think he just has this like energy about him in life in general, not just when he's acting, that like he, I don't know. He's just like, when you see him, like, for example, when he's on fucking A Tribe Called Quest songs, every song he takes the cake. I'm like, oh, Busta Rhymes brings this energy that just like is, you can't, it's just like magnetic. And even in the movie, like, he just had simple roles, but he added his like Busta Rhymes flair, and it was just like, so you just like want to be his best friend. I don't know what it is.
I'm with you, man.
Everything in his life that he touches and does, even just conversations he has, you're just like, God, you're like so engaging, and like, I just want to listen to you. And like, I don't know. He did a great job. I don't know what it is.
Busta can do no wrong in my book either, man.
Yeah, dude. I there's no flaws in him at all. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, I'm fucking with
I don't
you,
know how man. To like put it into words what like the factor is, but like literally, and when he's rapping, when he's acting, when he's just talking in an interview, I'm like, you are the most, like, you should run for president. You are the most engaging dude I've ever heard.
Yeah. He is, just to bring you back down to earth, I thought he did a terrific job in this movie, aside from the last scene he was in where he goes and delivers the note to Forrester.
Yeah, it's a little cheesy.
That's really fucking weird, man. He like really care about that. That's really fucking weird. The lines were kind of delivered too many times, so I don't know if that's totally his fault. But
no,
that wasn't amazing.
It wasn't. That's tough.
It did take me out because I was like, I know Busta. I know he's a rapper. I know this is not his thing, and he was doing so well earlier in the movie that I was like, okay, not a big deal.
I just think it's also tough for that character, because like, is that character developed enough to be like, hey, he had this genuine connection with you, and he like really likes you and looks up to you, and I've never seen my brother like be drawn towards someone like he is with you. I don't have that relationship. Like, there's so many ways you could have taken it, but is his character able to say all that? Is he what's the word, articulate enough?
Yeah, you're spot on. His character wasn't quite fleshed out enough for him to handle. Yeah,
we would need to know more about him.
You're totally right, because by that point the relationship between Jamal and Forrester was so fucking strong, and there was like, we were nearing pretty much at the apex, and for Busta to come in and just be the delivery guy and then to ask him to be much more than that is gonna be tough.
Yeah, and it's just like, we'd have to know more about him, and he like, so all he could say is like, man, I don't fucking know why he likes you, because you're 80. I don't know if you guys are fucking, but he really likes you. And that's weird. What you're doing is weird. And like, I can live with that. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I thought Anna Paquin's performance was great. My True Blood.
Yeah. Babe. Fucking, what's her name? Rogue from X-Men.
Also, first millennial to win an Oscar.
Anna Paquin,
man.
What movie?
That shocked me. The Piano in 1993. She was 11.
Like, I was about to say, four?
She was 11, and she won Best Supporting Actress at 11 years old.
I mean, you just take a look at that face, and you're like, you're meant to be on stage.
I swear, having a gap in your teeth helps, man. People believe you more.
She's just, it's not even like an attractive thing. It's just like, you have this face that like, you're like believable, but I don't know what it is, but you need to be on, you kind of, it's almost like if Helena Bonham Carter weren't super like eccentric and dressed up and you just had her, that's kind of the vibe you get from her. You're like a little spooky, a little mysterious just by your facial expressions. I don't know what it is.
Yeah. They're like vampire. That's it.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, man, we'll touch on this more. I immediately added The Piano to my watch list because I haven't seen it, but that was her first feature film, her first acting performance.
Well, yeah, it's kind of like that girl in what's it, Beast of Southern Wild. Did you ever see that?
No, I didn't.
So she got nominated. I don't think she won. I could be here. I'm looking it up right now. But she, it was her first acting performance. And she, I think she's younger. Yeah, she does a great job. I mean, like, I feel like if you get someone so young that you just, they don't know any better. They're like, oh, this is just life.
Beast of No Nation.
Yeah. Beast of Southern Wild. She was.
What? And Beast of No Nation. That kid, like, just popped off and had never really acted before.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, if you get someone who's just untouched, yeah, this girl was 9, and she was nominated for Best Actress, like, in the lead role. She got a Golden Globe nomination, yeah. But anyway, that's a movie we should definitely watch. But I feel like when you get these young actors that just are, like, still so young that they're, like, learning life and, like, you know, becoming not even becoming aware yet. Like,
they're still a sponge.
Exactly. So you could just be like, hey, this actor's like, they're not going to know if this actor yells at them, they're going to react by crying because they're like, what the fuck? What did I do? They don't know that it's like even a show. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And but then you're like Jamal and you get paired with a guy named Sean Connery and you tell him his name and Sean says, sounds like some kind of marmalade.
Yeah, that was so funny, dude. Jamal Wallace, what are you, an Arnold Palmer? You know, like, what the fuck was that?
He was fucking with him, though. I did like that they backed that up because it was really fucking weird.
It was weird.
He said that, and he's like, oh, so you're black, and you're 16, and you think you're a writer. And he was like, what does being black have anything to do with it? And he kept pushing his buttons, and he was like, I'm just seeing how much you can take. And I fucking love that they did that to try and see if any of this, like, he kind of, like, threw out surface-level race
to, like, affect him.
Yeah, just to see how affected he would be.
And the pursuit of knowledge just, like, drove Jamal, and he's like, I don't fucking care.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he's like, hey, don't let people shit on you, but also, like, I'm glad you have this maturity. And he's like, I don't actually think that, but I don't know. It was cool that they, because that's, like, when people, I dropped the mic. When people are watching, that's, like, the first thing they see. They're like, are they going to address this? And so the fact that they did it right away and then it was over. And they did it in such a
really
way.
Authentic way.
Yeah.
No, you're cool. Right. The elephant in the room. I mean, you watch this movie, especially in 2020, that's going to be on everybody's mind is, like, privilege this, privilege that, like, a white savior. That's why I tried to say it. Like, Gus Van Sant, I thought, did, like, an expert job 20 years ago bridging that gap, addressing the elephant in the room. And it's corny here and there, but not that much. Corny than Green Book.
Yeah, less corny than Green Book. Way less cornier than fucking Freedom Riders. I mean, there's so many movies we can name.
Yeah. There's so many good conversations in this movie, man. And, like, you like to write, man. Writing is a thing, like, that you enjoy. And I felt like this movie really, like, drove interest in writing for me. I was like, the way they talked about it, it didn't feel like fluff or any BS. Like,
no, they
so good, man.
Sean, his character, I don't know, he had a few lines where he talked about writing that I thought was, like, so, I don't know, I thought it was really cool. Yeah, he had a lot, and I was like, is he a writer in his, like, personal life, or, like, did he just really study up for this role? Because he said J.D. Salinger, the guy that wrote fucking Catcher in the Rye, I think,
yeah,
was his Salinger, however you say it, was his inspiration for this role.
Yeah, because Salinger's also a one-and-done writer. Yeah. Just like William Forrester, he had just one Pulitzer-winning novel and then never published anything else like Salinger.
Yeah, and yeah, so, like, I'm trying to think of what he said, but he just, like, there were a few distinct lines. But anyway, it was, like, I thought it was really cool, and I just liked how he was just, like, you just write. He's like, don't think, just write. And he's like, it'll like, lube you into the entry of writing, pretty much.
Yeah, so on that exercise that he was referring to, he just gives Jamal a New Yorker article he wrote back in the day, and he was like, here, just start typing there, just start typing what you're seeing, and then once it starts becoming your own words, that's when you'll know you're, like, in the zone or whatever, you know. He's like, just start typing, start, like, doing the act Mm-hmm. And then once your body is in rhythm, then you can apply your own creativity to it. And I was like, that is such a good exercise, like getting in the rhythm and then letting things go from there. Because if you do the opposite, wait for inspiration to motivate you to do the action, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, picking up the fucking pen or starting to type is so much harder. I think I also really liked, I don't know, man, there were so many ways this movie could have gone that would have cheapened it. And I think,
oh yeah,
when they go to the
and I was worried about it the whole time. I was like,
me too.
Oh, no,
I was waiting for it to happen.
Murder,
when they go to the Yankees Red Sox game, and he loses him or whatever.
And oh yeah, like, no, oh, he goes to the Knicks game.
So he loses him, and I'm like, oh, is he gonna fucking like have a heart attack and die? Is he gonna get robbed? Is he like gonna fall and hit his head? You know, because he's an old dude, and he has a panic attack. Which he would if he's an agoraphobe. Like, he doesn't ever leave his house. So he has a panic attack, which is super normal.
Yep.
And then Jamal finds him and they just go home. And you're just like, all right. I mean, like, it was probably traumatic for fucking Sean Connery's character, but then they addressed it and we're both like, okay, yeah, we don't need to watch this game. Let's go home.
That shit was so well done, man.
Yeah. Like, I loved that part.
Oh, my goodness. It could have gone so bad. And
People deal with anxiety and just like mental illness, like since 2000, so in such worse ways and such cheap ways that like just to do that and be like, "Yep, I'm freaking out," and but I'm good now, and let's take off. And they're like, "Clearly, I can't stay for the game. We should probably go."
Yeah,
but yeah, because that was really nice.
What's happening on like the external side of a panic attack or some sort of mental health like breakdown? It's not always like a freak out. Because a lot of the
it's super internal.
A lot of the like tragic aspects are happening inside your mind, and everybody looking outside, it's you look pretty normal. And I thought they, like you said, they didn't fluff that by any means.
And I really liked that. I thought they did a great job with that. And I love that Jamal probably wasn't really sure what was going on, but he's just like, this guy doesn't ever fucking leave his house. We gotta go. I tried and let's just go.
Jamal's like already shown that he's really smart. He listens, he understands people, he watches people, he observes them, he like figures them out. So like he wasn't like shocked, like, man, what? He could have been like, man, I'm missing the game, like I bought these tickets, man, what the fuck are you doing? They could have easily made it a freak out moment, but it was like, nope, let's go. I got plan B in the back of my mind, and they turned it into a fucking beautiful scene 2 minutes later.
I loved the movie, but the BMW scene, I just like couldn't get over. And in subtleties like this, they showed how fucking mature and intelligent Jamal is. And then like they had those few little kind of like you said, fluff scenes where I was like, ah, man, fuck. Like, I get it, but they could have like, I felt like Gus Van Sant could have been like, could have written it in a better way almost. Like that the whole BMW scene, and then the, I don't know if it was like the English class scene or when he's talking with Sean Connery in his house, like, and they're arguing writing rules. Like, I just feel like it could have been written better. That would be more apt to Rob Brown's character.
Yeah. So two things, the BMW scene didn't bother me that much because one, it didn't have a lot of impact on the movie. You know, it wasn't a plot affecting scene, and I think that it was probably included. I would I'm sure like producers were like, hey, we need to emphasize that this kid is smart, this is our early way of showing this is smart. And I guess like, you know, in 2000 reciting information like that, where they're like, this is how the audience will connect the dots and be like, this guy is smart.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they didn't do it in a subtle way like they were doing the rest of the fucking movie.
Yeah.
So it did stick out, but it didn't bother me that much in comparison to stuff towards the end. The like school board striking a bizarre deal to try and make a back alley deal with a 16-year-old, that was
to play that was basketball.
That was the biggest flaw to me, because significantly
affect the
plot.
Think about the high school you went to, dude. That shit happens.
Coaches
are like, hey, can this kid cheat off you? Because he needs to play football this weekend in state. Like, that shit happens.
It does happen, and I was thinking about those exact examples while I was watching what you just said, but the problem is they did like a quid pro quo, like, you do this for us and we do this for you. You mm-hmm. like win a championship in a team game and we will like sweep all this other stuff under the rug that's also not necessarily like actually problematic. It was so, and like the dude's 16 years old, and for this like adult to like see that as rational, that was too much for me. And then the ending was 90s as fuck, man. The speech that he gives was really good, but mm-hmm. why did they feel the need to put a montage in there? After 15 seconds of Sean Connery giving like the final like literature speech at Jamal's school.
Oh, you mean when he writes the letter to him and it just goes through Jamal's life or whatever?
No. Before
what
that.
Part? What part is the montage we're talking about?
When William Forrester goes to Jamal's school mm-hmm. at the end during the writing.
Yeah, and he fucking serves Crawford up a fucking told you so.
Yeah, before he serves him up, he like reads Jamal's work. Mm-hmm. And after the first 15 seconds of him reading the excerpt from it, they cut to a montage of like music, panning around the room.
You
know what I'm so
yeah, okay.
And then it fades back into the end of the speech.
Wish you just did the whole speech?
Or a condensed version of the speech. The montage, like, it was so corny. I couldn't believe it. And it was so 90s. And then immediately after that, having like this like open discussion in a room full of 100 plus people on like the morals of wrongfully expelling a student. Also, come on. What the fuck?
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous.
Little strange that like this random writer from like 30 years ago like has a say on what goes on in the school, and then also is like kind of the hero. I don't know, like the
exactly
person of logic when they're like, oh, this drunk just showed up to read exactly. something, and Crawford's like, oh, Mr. Forrester, you know.
Yeah, it was just too, you know, it's like it's the gotcha moment of the film that we were waiting for.
Yeah.
And I know there's no easy way to do that, but it feels like they saved all the 90s cliche moments for that part. And then, of course, like fast forward 10 minutes to the very end, we get hit with Is Over the Rainbow. And I'm like, Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure it was not played out in 2000. So I also will give a pass on that aspect of it.
Yeah, no, that song was that probably fucking introduced the song, the end of that movie.
It could
honest.
Have. Yeah, it did. I mean, if you look at it like contextually, like just in the context and era of this movie, it does slap for sure.
Oh yeah, and it was unexpected, to be honest. I did not think. Out of all of the songs that we're going to play at the end was fucking Over the Rainbow.
Oh, really? I was like, I like audibly was like, oh, really?
Yeah, so.
But, and then who rears his head in at the end?
Fucking Matty D, baby. Like always, Matt Damon.
We catching a Sox game after this?
Yeah, that's exactly what he said. Hey, what are you, where are you from, Southie? The guy's like, oh, South Bronx. And he's like, what is that? What is there? A bunch of blacks there? What are they, Hispanics? Gets like super Irish racist all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So that song didn't top the charts until 2010, 2011. It was put out in 93.
No way.
Yeah. No. It was released in 19... Hold on.
Yeah, get your shit straight.
Okay, it was first released on a strictly Hawaiian album. But then he has it. Brother Is has his big album called Facing Future that released in 93. And that song didn't top the charts until 2010.
Wow.
So okay. This is way ahead of its time.
Good, good. Okay. So the pass I gave is well deserved.
Yeah. So, but yeah, fucking Matt Damon came in and was like, oh, we're crushing brews and we're fucking hitting up the chicks on the block and maybe do a little coke off my friend Ben Affleck's cock. You know, and just good gonna... Irish fun.
I'm bringing the DeMarini with me wherever I go, just in case we want to hit the diamond.
Yeah. A few batting cages couldn't hurt, you know. Few more Samuel Adams down the gullet and a few more batting cages for the rest of the night. No pussy, because it's just about the boys.
Hey, Sean, you coming? You still watching that basketball?
Yeah. God, dude. That was so... Yeah, I did not know he's in the movie. And he gets credited, too. And I was like, all right. Don't sell us on Matt Damon being in the movie, you fuck.
Yeah, it's a weird choice, man. I get it. Like, Van Sant probably, like, spruced up some producing. He's like, oh, I got Matt on the phone. I got his phone number. I can bring him in for a quick one.
Yeah, there was, like, maybe a tough scene. Or, like, he gave some direction that was bad, and everyone started doubting him. And he's like, pulls out his phone and faking, oh, what's that, Matt? You want to come on set? Okay. Yeah. We got a role for you. Guys, we got a role for Matt. And then he just begged him after, like, when he was in his trailer, actually called him. Look, I'll give you $3 million. It's 5 lines.
$3 million, Jesus Christ.
Just gets caught in a lie because they stop trusting him. He's too avant-garde. Mm-hmm. That people are like, "This, we're fucking losing him."
Yeah. on this topic, man, so I looked up a bunch of reviews, and a lot of them are from, like, 2001, you know, like, following up on the awards post. This got zero anything. This got zero acknowledgement from the Oscars. And it seems to me a lot of people, like an overwhelming amount of viewers, saw this as a underwhelming follow-up for Gus Van Sant to Good Will Hunting.
Yeah.
And watching this now, like 20 years later, with no, you know, we're not even, you know, Good Will Hunting feels like another is completely separate from this film. And that's how it should be judged, right?
Yeah. No, I honestly didn't even know Gus Van Sant did this till after I watched the movie. And we had just been talking about him.
Yeah, exactly. We almost watched Milk for the politics part of this episode, and that's also Van Sant.
Oh, damn. Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck. Yeah. So we almost doubled up.
Yeah, I didn't really know, but I mean this competed with American Beauty, which is tough. American Beauty's great, but the rest of the movies I don't really know much about. But yeah, I think he just cleaned up with Good Will Hunting, and it's a different topic. It's like way heavier. Like, this movie isn't super heavy if you really think about it.
Right. And some people were kind of faulting the relationship between Jamal and Forrester, saying it wasn't as, you know, deep, wasn't as heavy, like you said, compared to Robin Williams and Matt Damon. But it's like, this is so different. Yeah. That's not,
and way ahead
just
of
because
time.
It's the same director doesn't mean that it warrants this. It's equivocating. You're falsely comparing two things. That's my take.
But I mean, to win Oscars, you have to have fucking heavy movies. Like, that's always been the thing. And I think that it just, this wasn't it, because I don't know. This just wasn't it because it wasn't heavy enough. And especially in the 90s, they wanted that fucking white savior role where it gets real emotional. And it just wasn't that. And I think it, for like, it's standing the test of time, did a great job, but mm-hmm. for that time and period, it's not really going to, you know, shake any votes out of it.
Yeah. And I want to say something about this soundtrack. I thought it was phenomenal, and it's another good example of how you can use contemporary music alongside a movie score to add, you know, you kind of add some richness to the atmosphere while still using traditional music elements of a movie score to, like, control like pace and mood and stuff like that. Like, you know, they have like the basic strings in piano when they need to.
Let's talk
and
about...
then they'll also play hip hop when they need to versus other, you know, like what is it called, fucking Great Gatsby, the new one, where they just like injected Jay-Z into it and it made no fucking sense. Like, you
was
have
a king
to
a god, and they're like, look at all these flappers, and you're like, what the fuck.
Oh my fucking God. I would love to review that movie, man. I would just dig into that shit. But this is it. Finding Forrester is such, they did.
Dude, and they had the classic, really knows, like classic 90s, late 80s saxophone, like in the in the dark in New York City when there's fucking steam rising and it's like, and you're like, what a time.
This the whole atmosphere of this movie I thought was captured so well, and it really speaks to Van Sant's like vision, and I think that's what's, you know, it really stands out for some of the more accomplished directors.
For sure. Should we score it?
Yeah, let's do it. You want to give your bit first? I write mine down, so I never want to like influence yours.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give it a 7.5. Because I just feel that there's so many good things that are like so, like we said, so subtle and so far ahead of their times as far as subtlety goes. And it had a lot of easy outs to be really about race when it wasn't, to be really about basketball as like his saving grace when it wasn't, to inject a like a romantic relationship and it wasn't, to have someone, to have a crime role because it's in the Bronx and it wasn't that. You know, there was just like so many ways it could have gone to cheapen it and be an easy out, and probably would have done better at the Oscars if like fucking Jamal got shot or something.
Dude, facts.
That big it would they would have been like, New York crime classic. Oh man, this is so gritty, when it didn't need to be that. And and I think absolutely. for movie watchers, it like it does, or for someone that's really into it, I think it makes it so much better. The only flaws were just like you said, like there are some 90s stuff in it. The BMW scene for me, and then the end when he's like, "Did you miss the shot on purpose?" And he's just like, "That's not much of a soup question," or whatever. I liked the soup question part, but the whole thing like where he missed a shot and looked directly at Crawford in the crowd, I was like, I get it. Like he's a kid and he's angsty, but like that part seemed kind of cheesy. So I give it a 7.5 total because all the other stuff it did so well, and it was just like so nice to see. But yeah, 7.5.
Fair enough. Yeah, this movie, man, I cannot talk about how well crafted these characters were, and there was a meaningful story to support them, and it almost dodges the cliches in its path, but I don't fault that too hard with this movie.
Yeah,
because it's just so difficult to, you know, circumnavigate all of, you know, the trends in many art forms, because that's where the populace is, you know, shifting you towards. But the essence of this movie, I think, is so strong. This is going to land at a high 7 for me. So I'm going to round up to an 8. This is a great fucking movie, man. Like I really felt something from this, and I was shocked too, because it wasn't super riveting, but I really, and I love all the, like, there's so many different philosophical and literature nods throughout the film, and I really appreciate that. And I feel like you can't get this right now, man. Like you can't, I don't see people giving this much attention to detail as far as characters go.
Yeah.
And it was so refreshing in that sense for me. So this is 8.
Yeah, and for something so, I guess not that it wasn't emotional, because there's a lot of emotion in it, but something that isn't so heavy and or like race driven or whatever, you don't see that as much anymore. And so I think even now, I think it's pretty awesome in that way. So I agree with your 8, but for me it's a 7.5. But yeah, man, it was a good movie. I hadn't seen it in so long that I didn't really remember what it was like. I just knew that Sean Connery was in it, and the actor who's in it actually later goes on to play in Treme, one of David Simon's shows after The Wire. Just a little fun fact. Yeah, I thought both movies were great. I thought it was a good double selection.
Yeah, definitely. I think this was definitely a step up from past couple of weeks. A couple of my favorite scenes though, man, when Jamal, the exercise I was telling you about where he hands him his old New Yorker article and he's like, just start typing, and then once your own words come to play, then take off. And he starts lightly typing on the typewriter, and he's like, What does he say? Smash him. Smash the damn thing.
Yeah, he's like angry about it.
Yeah, and then he starts doing it. He's like, Sean Connery's like, yes.
Yes. Yes.
And then he goes and sits down. You're the man now, dog.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, gets cheeky about it and smiles.
He gets cheeky about it. He uses Jamal's vernacular in such a playful and authentic way. I was like, man, that's good. That
would happen. You have to be in that relationship. That would 100% happen.
Exactly. And you have to be a professional to deliver something like that. So rest in peace, Sean Connery.
Yeah, man. All right.
Wild motherfucker, but God damn, did he have a hell of a career.
Great career. Was tough on the women, apparently. Kept a firm hand. But, living legend. Not anymore. But legend in his time. And, lived to be a healthy 90. Like, you can't complain about that. I mean, I don't know his personal life. But to live to be 90 and have had such a fulfilling career, I think that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and for those who are wondering why we didn't review a more recent Sean Connery movie, this is the second most recent one. Finding Forrester came out in 2000. A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, childhood favorite of mine, came out in 2003, and that was it for feature films. So this is, I was watching some old clips of Finding Forrester. People are jumping on. People are watching like crazy.
Yeah.
Finding Forrester jumped from the 6,200th most popular movie on IMDb up to the 146th.
Jesus.
So people are watching it right now, and I think that really gives me, it feels good, man. I hope like
for the future movie fans and like,
yeah,
the demand they create for movies.
100%. I hope other people watch this and got what I got out of it, because it definitely was a wonderful movie with really good performances.
Yeah.
And yeah, any last thoughts on that, Aiden, before we step away?
No, yeah. I mean Sean Connery is definitely a legend, and he will be missed. But yeah, crazy to me. I mean, we talked about this before the podcast, how 2003 was his last movie, and then lived another 17 years after being in the movie industry since 1954 till 2003. So almost like 49 years. And then I think he did two voiceovers, but didn't direct, didn't produce, just was out of it. And the fact that he did that and the next 17 years didn't do anything to do with the entertainment industry is crazy to me. Like, I really want to know what he did, because it makes it, I feel like it would just be very hard to go from that to not doing that for 17 years before you die.
Yeah, totally.
But, that's for another time. I also liked, there were a few scenes that I liked. I really liked when Jamal is just like trying to bullshit with him and he just like doesn't want to hear it. He's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, well, you know, my neighbors, they're fucking, and like she's screaming, you know, it's like a good scream. And he's just like, Sean Connery's just too mature, and like, you know, that's too like surface level talk for him to like get involved in it. And so he just waits for Jamal to like finish, and then he's like, all right, let's talk about something deeper or whatever. I liked that scene a lot. But yeah, two great movies. I think we did a good job. I think we should keep it rolling with another two or three good movies for the next podcast, definitely.
Yeah, so join us hopefully next week, within the next couple weeks, for more movie talk.
Potential name change and things. Stay tuned.
Yeah, I know I've been saying that for the last few episodes, but it's going to happen. More details to follow. But yeah, so that'll take us out. Until next time.